Today is September 16th, 2006, and this is the Weekly Roundup, a Mac Observer podcast. I'm Ricky Spiro.
And I'm Jeff Gamet.
We've been getting emails from a bunch of you telling us to fix Jeff's microphone and to turn down the bass a little bit. This is all audio stuff. Normally, I don't spend a lot of time on this, but I've been working on some of that audio stuff at the back end. And you should hear some of the improvements right now in this show. We're not quite where we want to be on audio quality. We're still working on it. Thank you, all of you, for sending in those emails. And we'll get that stuff fixed up as we go along.
And as always, to get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/roundup.
It's been a busy week, and we got a lot to talk about. A lot of you know I don't really like focusing on keynote product announcements, these big media events that Apple throws. It always seems taggy to get on the show and talk about all this stuff that they're covering in the mainstream media. But the fallout of this week's show actually deserves some really careful attention. So we'll speed through the news as fast as we can, since I figure all of you pretty much know what went down. But we'll kick back and really dig in to the real stuff here in the context machine.
Okay, so very quickly. At its Showtime Media event last Tuesday, Apple CEO Steve Jobs announced the addition of movies to the iTunes Music Store with a bit over 75 titles from Disney and its subsidiary studios. Movies will be available the same day that their DVD counterparts are released, and they'll be priced between $10 and $15. They're going to be 640 by 480 resolution, which is close but not quite DVD quality. They will also come with Dolby Surround audio.
Apple also used the occasion to update iTunes with new functionality and interface enhancements, including gapless playback and the ability to download album art. iTunes 7 also introduces the ability to use an iPod to sync content purchased from the iTunes Store, rather than what it was previously called, the iTunes Music Store, the iTunes Store, and you can sync those things among various computers. More importantly, in the short run, if less so in the long run, Apple announced updates to its iPod, iPod Nano, and iPod Shuffle products. The iPod got some minor upgrades, the Nano got a new case, and the Shuffle got cut drastically in size. Apple also dropped the price on the iPod. The 30-gigabyte model is now $250.
And finally, for announcements, Steve Jobs also previewed a new device codenamed iTV, which will connect to a television and wirelessly stream video and audio content as well as pictures from a computer. The device features HDMI, Wi-Fi, USB 2.0, Ethernet, component video, analog video, and digital audio connectivity. Users control it with a front row remote, and the on-screen interface demonstrated by Mr. Jobs featured a front row-like look. Apple expects to ship it during the first quarter of 2007 for $300. If you're interested, by the way, we also posted a photo gallery from the event.
So our Context Machine fodder this week includes all of those new products and factoids and everything else, along with last week's news about Amazon's music service, which we're going to talk a little bit about. The last piece of fodder for this week, though, is that Microsoft officially revealed the specifications for its first Zune media player on Thursday. It didn't, however, reveal the unit's price, which some analysts have opined is the result of Apple's unexpected price drop on the 30-gigabyte iPod. The three things that best differentiate the Zune from the other media players on the market are, first, it's a 3-inch screen, which actually has the same resolution as the iPod screen, just with bigger pixels. Second, it's a wireless networking device. It has Wi-Fi capability. And third, it's focused, at least as far as the marketing is going to be concerned, is on social networking. More on that when we get to the Context Machine.
There is one other important piece of news from this week. Apple on Tuesday added games for purchase from iTunes, playable only on fifth-generation iPods and not playable in iTunes. The titles are available for $5 each. Two were developed by Apple, and the other seven titles for sale were developed by third-party publishers.
Now, while it's an interesting news story, in fact, a very important news story, in my opinion, it will not be fodder for this week's Context Machine because I've already talked about it and predicted, at least in my way, the ramifications on a previous show. I'll make sure we link to that show in the show notes at macobserver.com/roundup. So we're going to get into the Context Machine now, and we're doing something for the first time in the revised version of this show. I have Jeff Gamet here, of course, as always. We're going to talk about the news. But I'm also joined, again, by Brian Chaffin. Brian, it's been a while since you've been on the show. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
Cheers. All right, well, let's start with the iTunes movie store now. The iTunes store, I suppose, most generally. The price structure here is going to be between $10 and $15, and there's this thing about when the movies were released, how long ago, whether they're new releases, whether they're pre-releases, whatever. Between $10 and $15. All of the songs are priced at exactly $1. The variation between $10 and $15, does that mean that Apple lost at the negotiating table to some degree?
Maybe. I don't think that Apple is facing the same issue when it comes to pricing between songs and movies. I mean, the songs are much more of a impulse buy than a movie is, although certainly a movie could still be an impulse buy. So when Apple's talking about having an inexpensive concept like a single, I think that the uniform pricing makes a lot of sense. When it comes to something like movies, I don't really think it's even the same argument. So I would actually be surprised if Apple was ever even asking for uniform pricing with movies.
Jeff, does that seem likely to you that Apple never asked for uniform pricing?
They may have asked, but I agree with Brian on this one. I don't think that uniform pricing is something that Apple was striving for, because this is a different type of product. I'm sure you're going to see a lot of people that say, well, they should all be $10 or less, but you can't make everyone happy. And this seems like the best compromise between price and product that I've seen from any of the services.
All right. Now, again, I guess I'll toss this one to Brian. Apple's argument in 2003 with the record labels was that the iTunes Music Store, as it was being launched, needed to have a simple pricing structure. It needed to be really easy to use in order to compete with file sharing. And that argument worked. So do you think that let's back up for a second and just ask the question, would that even have made sense to Disney? Would Disney ever have agreed with that idea?
Piracy with movies is again not quite the same issue as it is with songs, because songs are so much smaller, even full albums are so much smaller. They could be traded a lot more easily than a movie can. Now, certainly there is piracy of movies, and although nowhere near to the degree of it being a problem that the movie industry itself is trying to make out, but that's probably a discussion for another show. But the point is that it's just not as much of a problem yet, simply due to bandwidth limitations. So I don't think that. Actually, let's back up a little bit further. Let's back up a little bit more.
That'll do.
I'm still backing.
And look at where we were then and where we were and where we are now in terms of the industry as a whole. Because at that time, the idea of selling music online was while not untested, it was unproven. And Apple clearly brought that to monstrously mainstream success. So now I don't think Apple had to go to the labels, to the movie studios and say, okay, look, you've got this issue. I've got this wild idea. Let's sell movies. Everybody knew that this was coming. Everybody's been working on getting movies online. Everybody's been wanting to bring the same success to digital distribution with movies that the music industry has seen with digital distribution. So again, it's an apples and oranges comparison. It's just an apples and oranges comparison.
Now, you started talking about the lead time, essentially, that people have had with the movie stores, the fact that everyone knew this was coming. One of the corollaries of that is that the movie industry has seen everything that happened with the music industry, and they have a lot more information than the music industry had when they signed on to their deals with iTunes. And I'm curious, I want us to talk a little bit about what the studios were looking for here, what they want to get out of these deals. When we talked about the record companies in 2003, people were saying the record companies are trying to survive. They're trying to get out from under this rock of file sharing. That doesn't seem to be, like you said, Brian, that doesn't seem to be the issue here. So first of all, Jeff, let me ask you this. Do you think that there's anything about the iTunes Music Store that kind of sets it back, that prevents it from being a runaway success? The reason I'm asking that question, it's a very loaded question, is because a lot of the stuff I've read in the mainstream media has said, you know, they didn't do this. It wasn't as splashy a store because of the variable pricing and whatever other considerations as it was in 2003. So do you think that this is somehow crippled or prevented from being the perfect digital music store in any way?
You know, the only way you're going to have the perfect digital music store is to find a way to give every consumer every movie they want to see for free and still have a way for all of the studios to make as much money as they can possibly dream of. And we know that's not going to happen. So instead, we have a middle ground. Now, I think that we didn't see as splashy, so to speak, of a rollout for the movie store as we did for the music store, because Apple didn't have to do that. They really had to draw attention to the iTunes Music Store when it started, because it truly was a new, untested product. And it's certainly tested now, and it's holding up well, and it's the best there is. So they didn't have to put in that initial hype that says, we're the best, come on, just try it out. You know, instead they could add in the content and say, okay, we've got it, we know how to do it right. You know where to find us.
Now, that was a statement more or less from Apple's perspective. Brian, I want to ask you about a statement from the movie studio's perspective. There's a lot of discussion among analysts and pundits, particularly in the mainstream media, about the movie industry protecting their current sources of revenue. How much of a factor is that in the deal that the movie studios made with Apple, or that Disney in this case, and presumably the other studios that will sign on in the coming weeks or months? How much of that, protecting their existing revenue, whether it's cable distribution or DVD sales or on-demand, pay-per-view, whatever, how does that factor into this deal that they made?
Well, I can sum that up in two words, one of which is hyphenated: mo money. The labels want mo money, and they want mo money for nothing, just like the record labels. Actually, just like most companies. Most companies, of course, want to get more profit for less work. But I don't think that you can say that the studios are pricing their movies with Apple or Amazon in order to protect their DVD sales. And the reason for that is quite simply because they're making more profit from these downloads than they are with DVD sales. I have zero doubt that the studios would love for DVDs to go away tomorrow if they could replace each and every one of the sales with the digital download. They would make vastly more money. So it's not an issue of them trying. Don't get me wrong. Big media is always trying to protect its existing business model. Big media always resists any new innovation. Big media always tries to control any new innovation. This is especially true in the last 20 years, as the laws in the United States in particular have leaned more and more and more in their favor and away from the rights of consumers. Can I say it? Can I bring out the F word?
Please.
This, of course, is one of the tiny elements of fascism that has been pervading our country in the last couple of decades. But really, that's just to get folks riled up a little bit. So anyway, the point is that so we've got this mix. We've got them trying to balance their old revenue sources and their, you know, their syndication deals and their cable rights. They're certainly trying to balance all those things, but at the same time, they want to get more money. And they want to get as much money as they can from these downloads. And if they can sell these things at 10 to 15 bucks a piece, they will. Now, it is my personal opinion that even $10 is way too much for a movie, just like I think 10 bucks is way too much for an album. You know, with digital distribution, I think that digital distribution should be a lot cheaper, reflecting their lack of production costs. Drives me nuts, but that's beside the point. If the industry can roll this out at these prices and they will sell at these prices will stick.
And when you said fascism, by the way, there was a nice stutter in Skype that made it much more dramatic. I want to toss a question to both of you. I want to toss a question to both of you about the usability of this thing. I assume that you've gone into iTunes and tooled around a little bit. Is this going to work for consumers? Like when you go into that store and shop for stuff, is it a pleasant experience to shop for a movie there? Like, do you like it? Do you think it's going to work for consumers? And Jeff, why don't you start?
All right. Actually, I've gone into the new iTunes store. I've looked around. I have downloaded a TV show from the new store already, just to see how the whole thing worked. And what I found was that it's just as easy to navigate as it's always been. It just so happens you're looking for movies now instead of songs. But boy, you better have a fast broadband connection or you're going to be waiting a while. I tested by downloading the season finale of Lost, which is about an hour and a half long. And I think it took about 40 minutes on my really fast cable modem connection.
Brian, anything to add to that?
Well, you know, we've all grown up in an analog world. Even young people, you know, whether or not they realize it, certainly have more analog experience than they do digital experience. And there's something to be said for walking into a DVD store or a record store and thumbing through the physical displays and, you know, trying to figure out what you want. And, you know, these digital stores, iTunes in particular, can't match all of that stuff, all the tactile things that you can get out of those stores. But at the same time, you know, you can also see a lot more things a lot faster. You can do, you know, finds and searches and all these other things that will help out. And to that end, I think that Apple's done about as good a job as, well, let me rephrase that. I don't think anybody else will be able to touch the experience that Apple's giving folks with the new movie store. I think it's a good interface, certainly better than everything else out there. And I'm sure that Apple's going to sell a ton of these movies.
And now let's get into it. Go ahead.
I was going to say, adding in the cover flow style way of being able to flip through albums on the store is really nice too. Although one thing that I do miss from the iTunes Music Store, which Brian touched on, something you can't get is that tactile thing. And one thing that I fear if everything goes to a digital world is that I won't be able to have my physical album to hold and touch and the little booklets to flip through and read my liner notes. That's all going to go away. I don't like that idea.
I also don't like the idea of losing the added features and the other things that have been accompanying DVDs now in ever increasing quantities. I think that those extra features are way cool. They're tremendous added value, and that's something that Apple can't offer. And it's something that will keep me buying DVDs simply because I enjoy those extra features. And I'm sure that a lot of people that will be the case for too. But again, lots of folks are going to be buying these movies.
Now let's get into a little bit of the comparison game here between Apple's service and Amazon's service. Amazon came out with a movie download service last week. Jeff, if you've looked at the Amazon store, can you tell us anything about the comparison between the Amazon store and the iTunes movie store in terms of usability?
Actually, Ricky, that's really not a fair comparison because the iTunes Music Store is usable and the Amazon Unbox Store sucks. And it sucks in a big way. It is that bad and worse. Amazon
so it's not a fair comparison.
Well, it's unfair to Amazon. I mean, of course we can compare them and say, this one's really good and this one sucks.
Well, I guess
that's
we'll
funny
just
that something could be so bad that it's not fair to compare it to something that's better.
Yeah, well, you know, that's my soft thing. Heart coming through.
All right. Well, in that case, we'll just leave that by the roadside. I guess that's Amazon's Unbox. We'll just leave that in the gutter. The one other thing that I did want to ask about the Amazon deal, do we have any reason to believe that Apple got a better deal from Disney than Amazon got from all the other movie studios, Brian?
Maybe. I think I understand where your question is coming from and that Apple's pricing is a little bit better. Apple at least carries as much weight as Amazon, and that's something when you consider what kind of retailing giant Amazon is. But Apple also has connections with Disney relating to Jobs being on the board and the Pixar buyout and all those other things that might have made negotiations a little bit better. Certainly Bob Iger has been very, very anxious and willing to work with Apple since his ascendancy to the CEO-ship of that company. So, you know, maybe, but I don't really know that Apple got so much. I kind of think it's a silly question to ask, and I'm not picking on you, Ricky. I don't know that we can know that until we see more movies coming down the pipeline.
And that seems reasonable. The other thing that's at issue here is that Apple only has a deal with Disney right now. It seems that what they did with the TV shows was to come up with a distribution agreement with Disney and then let everybody else fall into line. If Apple was looking for a uniform pricing structure, even if it's not uniform pricing itself, maybe this is how they plan to get it. If the movie studios weren't allowing or weren't agreeing to uniform pricing structure, now they've got Disney on board and they can allow or they can strong-arm the other studios to fall in line. Does that make sense, Jeff?
I think so. Disney, like they did with the music or with the video store features, is going to show that it's a viable model. Everyone else is going to fall in line. And it goes back to Brian's hyphenated phrase, mo money. And the different studios are going to line up because they see the iTunes Store as a really good place to get mo money.
All right, now let's move on very quickly. How big a deal is this iTunes update, Brian? How important is it for Apple to continue to update iTunes, continue to improve the interface? I mean, one could make the argument they're already on top.
Well, that's absolutely the case. I don't think that Apple needs to improve usability to stay on top until another competitor can come even close to its usability. If anything, the thing that Apple needs to focus on is the behind-the-scenes working of iTunes within Windows. The only complaints I've ever heard from Windows has been, from iTunes has been from Windows users who say that it has various quirks that are probably related to various things that Apple has never had to deal with before, such as different sound cards and different video cards and all these other things. So anyway, the point is that it doesn't hurt for Apple to perpetually stay on top. I think that this iTunes 7 is just, I think, a markedly improved interface. It is just substantially better than previous versions of iTunes. But Apple didn't have to do it to get more market share. They didn't have to do it to stay ahead because no one else is still with them. It just keeps them that much further ahead.
All right. And I also want to talk about ITV here. Jeff, they released it or they announced it without releasing it, which is very unusual. Now, that only happens. People only change their policy if something changes here. What has changed? What's the difference in circumstances that caused Apple to tip its hand?
I think Apple was giving its competitors a warning, a shot across the bow, so to speak, just saying, you know, be ready because we are taking over. And so this was just a little taste of letting everyone see. The other part of it, I think, is that when they rolled out all of these new products at their It's Showtime event, which, by the way, Brian, what a great guy. You had to go through so much to be there and get your pictures and having to stand back in the corner, and what a guy. But I digress. Anyhow, the point is they needed to show a full package. And to do that, they had to say, oh, and by the way, we do have this other product, because they built everything up and they didn't have the final piece. And everyone would have been left hanging, and there would have been a lot of people very disappointed with the event, I think, because it wasn't a full package. And by showing ITV, they said, look, we do have the full package. You just don't get all of it yet.
And by the full package, you're talking about the part of this puzzle where you download movies, but you want to be able to play them on your TV, and you're
right.
Talking about the part that connects that. Brian, I'm curious, what's your reaction to ITV? You were, as Jeff was saying, you were at the show. What was your impression of this product when he demoed it?
Isn't it interesting that an Apple media event, basically an Apple press conference, can actually be called a show?
That was a Freudian slip. I didn't even realize it.
Well, it probably stems from, of course, the fact that most of our quote-unquote shows are actually Macworld Expo, which actually is a show. Nonetheless, I first am just absolutely compelled to sort of emphasize something that Jeff said. If Apple had announced the movie downloads and there had not been a way to easily play it on your TV, all the attention from the mainstream media would have been about how stupid it is to buy movies when you can't play them on your TV. That's what people would have been focusing on. So Apple basically nipped that entirely. It actually didn't even nip it in the bud. Apple completely changed the rules on which the movie offering itself was going to be. Let me try that one more time. Apple set the rules by which the movie download service was going to be judged, and that, of course, is really smart. And the fact that they are at the same time able to put a bunch of FUD into the market for their competitors is the icing on the cake. So what was the question you actually asked me?
Well, I was asking you what your reaction to the product was. Given all those things, do you think that this product delivers that? Do you think that it is what Apple wanted it to be?
Absolutely. The ITV is going to, it's a great product. I said this in the Mac Notables review with Chuck. I think it may have gone up today. I'm not sure. But ITV is basically a closed system Mac. You know, it's everything that Front Row should be. You know, when Apple introduced Front Row, the interface for Front Row, everything that Front Row did is just, in my personal opinion, far better than any of the other set-top sort of media computer kind of products that are out there. But it Front Row made it to where if you're going to use it, you have to be either watching computer in your dorm or in your office, or have at best a 30-inch TV in your living room. Of course, 30 inches is plenty for some folks, but you know, a lot of other people want very large TVs in the living room. Now, Front Row changes all that. It bridges your computer to your living room. It is, you know, does so with all these different kinds of connectivity options. And I mean, that's just fantastic. I think it's a great product. I think that it is the piece that Apple needed to complete the ownership process of the digital living room.
Far more so
than the media PC.
And that's a Windows media big PC. Donut of a statement. We'll see how it's received when it actually gets released. And speaking of when it's released, there was a question that a number of people were asking, and I actually got an email from Mats from Sweden, one of the listeners who is asking a very intelligent and important question. If ITV is technologically ready, and it appears to be essentially, I mean, they were demoing it, they had it there, you could look at what it was doing. If it's essentially ready, why are they waiting until 2007 to release it? Why? What's the thing that stands between releasing it in, say, the next month or two? And Jeff, do you want to take that one?
Sure. Well, I think there's probably a couple things that are holding it back right now. First, there's probably some feature that isn't working up to Steve Jobs' standards, or there's some component that's not working reliably, or the pieces may not be available to produce these in mass yet. And you know, one of the questions that has been coming up is Apple waiting for a new wireless standard that will be more efficient at dealing with the data that needs to go through the air to your television. And that's a possibility too.
And right now it sounds like you're talking, we did run an article on this toward the end of the week about 802.11n. And Jeff, can you tell us, just summarize for people what 802.11n is and why that fits into what you just said?
Well, the nice thing about the N standard is that first we're going to be able to get more bandwidth, but it's also going to be more robust at dealing with all of this extra data that's going through the wireless pipeline. So keep in mind that in most households, you will have the computer on the network, but you'll probably also have another computer or two along with the ITV. So all of these different devices are fighting for that bandwidth, and the N standard is going to be more robust at dealing with that. To me, that's what I see as the biggest benefit of the N standard.
Brian, any other reasons why you can imagine that Apple hasn't planned to release this before the holiday season?
No, if Apple could release it before the holiday season, they would. Nothing more can be said about that. If it was possible to release it before the holiday season, Apple would, period. But clearly that means that there's either a technology that's not in place or some development that still needs to be done, or you know, they're waiting for a chip to come out that's going to combine a couple of different protocols into one, or you know, some other component pricing issue that they need to have in place in order to make money on the thing at $299, you know, or perhaps all of these things combined. I know, by the way, that what was it that Brad sent us, Jeff, about?
Yeah, it was about Intel's other standard, 16-205. Does that sound correct?
Yes, we basically got a letter from someone talking about another technology from Intel that I, in theory here, is being called 802.16-2005 that is far more suited to what ITV would do than 802.11n. So, you know, and which, by the way, is supposedly supposed to come out sometime in the first quarter of 2007 on a chip. So we'll actually
which
have
would
to
be
see
a coincidence
working out. Indeed. Yeah.
All right. Well, we're kind of nearing the end of this set of issues. The one other thing that I want to give us a chance to touch on before we wrap this up, let's say first Brian and then Jeff, where does this leave us headed into the holiday season? Namely, where does it leave Apple? If we look back at the last holiday season, which was a blowout for Apple, they had a terrific time last holiday season. They released a bunch of iPod models, two new versions of iTunes. How does this holiday season compare? We got new iPod Nanos, upgraded iPods. It looks like there's not much more to upgrade. So what's the path between here and the end of the year, Brian?
Mo money. seriously, Apple is going to sell so many iPod Nanos that, I mean, the new iPod Nano is going to be incredibly popular, just massively popular. It's a great looking device, and it you know, combines the best features of the Nano with the iPod Mini, and the iPod Mini was at the time of its demise the best-selling iPod of all time. Apple is also going to sell just a ton of the new Shuffles. That thing is just cool. Everyone's going to want one. Everybody that already has two shuffles in their house is going to end up having another two of the new ones. I mean, the company is going to sell a lot. And the lower price point on the full body iPods is going to mean larger market distribution, or, better market penetration for that device too. So it's going to be another great quarter for the company.
And, you know,
full disclosure, I do own a very tiny, tiny, tiny stake in Apple.
Now, there's another company, I don't know who it is yet, that's going to make some serious money this holiday season, and that's the company that comes to market first with an iPod Shuffle adapter to USB that doesn't require the dock. So you can plug a Shuffle directly into your Mac the way you do now with the current pack of gum size Shuffle. Those things will sell really well too.
Yep.
So whoever makes that first, you know, send me a dollar for giving you the idea.
And I guess we leave it on that, unless anyone has anything else they want to get off their chest before we head out here.
And what's up with Virgin Atlantic banning all Apple and Dell laptops, whether or not they're part of a battery recall? What's up?
Oh, yeah, we just ran that story at the very end of the week. Jeff?
You know, I have to get on a soapbox here for a minute, and so fair warning. This whole thing with banning laptops en masse is lame beyond belief on many levels. First, because you're banning laptops that otherwise are perfectly fine, but then you're also putting a potential burden on the airline people. They now have to sit there and try and figure out what's a MacBook Pro and what's a PowerBook G4. Yeah, right.
Oh, no,
like, that's going to happen.
All Apple laptops are banned. That's the problem.
Right. But like, if you go to Qantas, who has banned the laptops as well, they've only banned the iBook G4, the PowerBook G4, and that's it. But, you know, who's going to know the difference? And now, say I need to fly on one of those airlines with my PowerBook G4 that has its brand new battery. They don't know the difference, and now I have to pay the price for this short-sighted, myopic mess that these airlines are creating. And, you know, once you start doing something like this, it's like freedoms, because in a manner of speaking, this is a freedom, taking your laptop on an airplane. When you give up a freedom, it's a lot harder to get it back. So I don't expect to see these airlines lifting their laptop bans for a long time.
Brian, you think we're stuck with this thing?
No, I think that it'll be resolved relatively quickly. I mean, I understand exactly what Jeff is saying, but the airlines are going to face a lot of problems from customers who are not going to be happy about being able to use their laptops on board if it goes on for too long, and they simply aren't going to be in a position to tolerate that. By they, I'm talking about the airlines. They're not going to be able to afford to lose business because of this.
I hope you're right and I'm wrong on this one. Of course, I'm also pissed off that I can't take my toothpaste on the airplane.
And that's a whole different story. I guess that'll have to be the last word. Brian, thank you for joining us.
Yes. Yay. Woo. My pleasure.
If you have questions or thoughts about the news, you can send them, as always, to roundup@macobserver.com.
Okay, let's do the product roundup.
Freeverse on Monday published Lineform, a vector drawing application. A free preview is available now, and it will produce watermark-free images until October 7th, and then it'll expire. Pricing is $80. A download version of Lineform is available now, with a retail edition headed to stores this fall.
Miglia Technology announced the TV Book Pro for the MacBook Pro on Monday. This product is an express card-based portable digital television receiver. The card includes Elgato's ITV2 software, which we'll actually be looking into on a show in the not-too-distant future. The TV Book Pro will be available in Europe in early October and is priced at €149. Now, for those of you that are looking forward to this product in the United States, sorry to tell you, it takes advantage of television radio transmission services that are not available in this country.
Native Instruments on Wednesday introduced five products set to ship next month. They are Massive, Absinthe 4, Battery 3, FM 8, and Complete 4, the last of which includes all the previous products along with acoustic piano and eight additional applications. We don't have time to talk about all those applications, but they're all pretty heavy-duty software instruments. The full version of Complete 4 will be $1,500, and there are various upgrade options depending on which Native Instrument apps you already have.
And Otherworld Computing announced the immediate availability of 2 GB memory upgrade kits for Apple's new iMac Core 2 Duo on Thursday. The kits are priced starting at $260.
SpaceTime Associates announced the immediate availability of TinyBooks 4 on Friday. TinyBooks is an accounting and bookkeeping application. The updated version adds support for several tax formats and international dates, among other improvements. TinyBooks 4 costs $50.
Skype announced on Wednesday that it has added cross-platform video call support to its Mac Internet voice chat application. Skype for Mac 2.0, which is still in beta, allows one-on-one video chats with both Mac and Windows, and is compatible with Apple's iSight camera as well as several other web cameras. Skype also released Skype for Mac 1.5 on Wednesday, which is an update to the current version of the application. The Skype software is free. And that's the news. Thanks for listening to the Weekly Roundup.
Our content is written by the staff of the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom for TMO. Podcast Expo is in 2 weeks. I'm going to be there. I'm going to be on a panel. TMO will be there. Shoot me an email. Shoot us an email, roundup@macobserver.com, if you're going to be in the area or if you'd like to show up at that panel. Let us know if you're going to be there. That's all I got.
And we do appreciate the emails everyone's been sending us with product ideas they'd like us to review. Please keep those coming in and stay subscribed.
Until next week, we will see you online.